And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it's April 24th. The 114th day of the year. And everybody's still locked down. Now, it's been an interesting day in history. 1479 BC, Thutmose III ascended the throne of Egypt, although power effectively shifted to Hatshepsut, who was ruled as a female pharaoh. 1183 BC, traditional reckoning of the fall of Troy marked the end of the legendary Trojan War, given by the chief librarian of the Library of Alexandria. 1547 AD, the Battle of Muhlberg. The Duke of Alba, commanding Spanish imperial forces of Charles I of Spain, defeated troops of the Smalcaldic League. 1558, Mary, Queen of Scots, marries the Dauphin of France, Francois, at Notre Dame in Paris. 1704, first regular newspaper in British colonial America, the Boston News Letter, is published. 1800, the U.S. Library of Congress is established when President John Adams signs legislation to appropriate $5,000 to purchase such books as may be necessary for the use of Congress. 1877, the Russo-Turkish War. The Russian Empire declared war on the Ottoman Empire. 1885, American sharpshooter Annie Oakley is hired by Nate Salisbury to be part of the Buffalo Bills Wild West show. 1895, Joshua Slocum, the first person to sail single-handedly around the world, set sail from Boston aboard the sloop Spray. 1913, the Woolworth Building, a skyscraper in New York City, is opened. 1914, the Frank Hertz experiment, a pillar of quantum mechanics, is presented to the German Physical Society. 1915, the arrest of 250 Armenian intellectuals and community leaders in Istanbul marks the beginning of the Armenian Genocide. 1916, Irish rebels led by Patrick Pearse and James Connolly launch an uprising in Dublin against British rule and proclaim an Irish Republic. That same year, Ernest Shackleton and five men of the Imperial Transatlantic Expedition launch a lifeboat from uninhabited Elephant Island in the Southern Ocean to organize a rescue for the crew of the sunken Endurance. 1918, first tank-to-tank combat during World War I. This happened during the Second Battle of Villers-Bretonneux. Three British Mark IVs met three German A7Vs. 1922, the first segment of the Imperial Wireless Chain provided wireless telegraphy between Leafield in Oxfordshire, England, and Cairo. Comes into operation. 1926, the Treaty of Berlin is signed. Germany and the Soviet Union each pledge neutrality in the event of an attack on the other by a third party for the next 5 years. 1932, Benny Rothman leads the mass trespass of Kinder Scout, leading to substantial legal reforms in the United Kingdom. 1933, Nazi Germany began its persecution of Jehovah's Witnesses by shutting down the Watchtower Society office in Magdeburg. 1944, the SBS launches a raid against the garrison of Santorini in Greece. 1953, Winston Churchill is knighted by Queen Elizabeth II. 1955, the Bandung Conference ends. 29 non-aligned nations of Asia and Africa finish a meeting that condemns colonialism, racism, and the Cold War. 1957, the Suez Canal is reopened following the introduction of UNIF peacekeepers into the region. 1963, the marriage of Princess Alexandra of Kent to Angus Ogilvie at Westminster Abbey in London. 1965, civil war breaks out in the Dominican Republic when Colonel Francisco Camano overthrows the triumvirate that had been in power since the coup d'etat against Juan Bosch. 1967, cosmonaut Vladimir Komarov dies in Soyuz 1 when its parachute fails to open. He's the first known human to die during a space mission. 1967, American General William Westmoreland says at a news conference, enemy had gained support in the U.S. It gives him hope he can win politically, that which you can't win militarily. And unfortunately, that was a fairly perceptive statement. 1970, China launches Dongfang Hong 1, becoming the fifth nation to put an object into orbit under its own using its own booster. Also in 1970, the Gambia becomes a republic within the Commonwealth of Nations when Dauda Harara as its first president. 1980, eight U.S. servicemen die in Operation Eagle Claws, the attempt to end the Iran hostage crisis. 1990, STS-31, the Hubble Space Telescope, is launched from the Space Shuttle Discovery. Also in 1990, Granard Island in Scotland is officially declared free of the anthrax disease after being quarantined for 48 years. 1993, an IRA bomb devastates the Bishopgate area of London. 1996, in the U.S., the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 is passed into law. 2004, the U.S. lifts the economic sanctions imposed on Libya 18 years before as a reward for its cooperation eliminating weapons of mass destruction. 2005, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger is inaugurated as the 265th Pope of the Catholic Church, taking the name Pope Benedict XVI. 2011, WikiLeaks start publishing the Guantanamo Bay files leak. 2013, a building collapses near Dhaka in Bangladesh, killing 1,129 people and injuring 2,500 others. Also in 2013, violence in Baku County, Kashgar Prefecture of China's Xinjiang, results in the death of 21 people. Large number of births and deaths on this particular date. Holidays and observances. The Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day in Armenia and France. Christian feast days, Benedict Mini, Dermot of Armagh, Diphnut of Anglesey, Eckhart of Ripon, Fidelis of Sigmaringen, Gregory of Elvira, Ivo of Ramsey, Johann Walter, Lutheran, Mary of Clopas, Mary Euphrasia Pelletier, Miletus, Peter of St. Joseph de Bentecour, Salome, Wilfred, Church of England, William Fermatus, and Eastern Orthodox Liturgics, Concord Day in Niger, Democracy Day in Nepal, earliest day on which Arbor Day can fall, April 30th is the latest, celebrated on the last Friday in April, and it's also the earliest day on which Turkmen Racing Horse Festival can fall. April 30th is the latest, celebrated on the last Sunday in April in Turkmenistan. Fashion Revolution Day and its related observances. Labor Safety Day in Bangladesh. Kepyong Day in Australia and Canada. National Pansayati Raj Day in India. St. Mark's Eve, Republic Day in Gambia. And World Day for Laboratory Animals. They have their own day. Who knew? Well, we have been talking about the Dark Fleet, which is said to be a secret Nazi space program. We were talking about Base 211 and the mystery of the missing Nazis. At the end of the war, 10,000 young Ukrainian women, all blonde and blue-eyed, and 2,500 Waffen-SS, literally vanished, along with 50-some-odd
Nazi submarines. Now, the Skoda Works was very instrumental in what was supposedly built in the way of circular craft. George Patton's Third Army arrived at Skoda Works in mid-April 1945, 6 days before the Russians. By that time, there was no evidence of the Hanabu development and manufacture, and General Kammler was gone with all the records. He was never found. Clearly, he had escaped to New Swabenland by plane and submarine, along with the plans and models for the Hanabu. So his expertise became available to the Antarctic scientist around that time, which helped explain why the Nazis were ready for Operation High Jump in late 46. The flying disc had been perfected during 1946, so they were ready for action by the next Antarctic summer, which is when Bird's operations began. The noted Bulgarian-born researcher and self-described dissident scientist Vladimir Trzynski claims that a different anti-gravity propulsion technology was used for the so-called Viral craft designed by the German scientists Richard Methe and Rudolf Schreiber. These discs were developed in the early 40s, and according to Trzynski, the Methe rocket craft was built in diameters of 15 and 50 meters, and the Schreiber-Walter turbine-powered craft were designed as an interplanetary exploration vehicle. He claims it was this technology that achieved a moon landing as early as 1942. He says the first landing on the moon by the Germans was at Mir Imbrium on August 23, 1942, using a Methe rocket. The first man on the moon was Captain Lieutenant Werner Theisenberg of the Kriegsmarine. Landing took place without radio contact to the main control center at Wilhelmshaven, or the second control center located near Anzio, Italy. And ever since their first day landing on the moons, the Germans started boring and tunneling under the surface. By the end of the war, there was a small Nazi research base on the moon. Now, this mission undoubtedly originated somewhere in Germany, but after the war, all Nazi space travel originated from New Swabenland. That was the so-called Base 211, about which so much has been written. Now, the Nazi plan to implement the Fourth Reich depended on the takeover of the American economy, especially banking, as well as the media, the aerospace industry, and the military. They didn't expect to win World War II once the U.S. entered the war in 1941, despite Hitler's public bluster to the contrary. All his speeches had only one purpose. They were calculated to win over and maintain the worship and trust of the populace, and it certainly worked. But the military leaders knew better. They knew that America was a sleeping giant, protected from invasion by two oceans, with tremendous industrial potential, and that they wouldn't be able to compete with German industrial might, with American industrial might once it got set in motion. They learned well the lesson of the Kaiser. Chief of Staff General Ludwig Beck refused to swear an oath of loyalty to Hitler for that reason and resigned in 1938. Even during the war, they had depended on American-built Ford vehicles as well as refined American petroleum. But they knew they'd be ahead in terms of new bioscience and aerospace technology and weaponry once it was moved to Antarctica, which would allow them to take the upper hand in the solar system, especially on the moon and Mars. So they basically abandoned their European base of power and focused on building a base of operations in South America and Antarctica. As early as 1943. And this may explain why they decided to invade Russia instead of England and America. They wanted to keep the American industrial superstructure and economy intact until they could take it over. And they were supremely confident because they had the invaders' technology and the solar system accessible base of operations in Antarctica to rely on. Now, the invaders had many reasons for wanting human colonies under their control out in the solar system and beyond, but mainly their plan was to get their Nazi lieutenants there first so they'd be in control when the rest of the human race achieved space travel and settlements, and the humans then could then be enslaved to work on other planets as they were on Earth. When the Star Trek generation would arrive on the moon and Mars, they would encounter perhaps toned-down versions of Auschwitz, where work makes one free would be emblazoned over the entrance gate and where slavery could be used because the human spirit would be crushed. And that is the current situation, according to many. The only humans who are now permitted to come to Mars are slaves, unless they're part of the interplanetary corporate conglomerate, or the MDF. Base 211 was the key to the Nazis' expansion out into the solar system, and even though they were developing facilities over Argentina, their main technical and scientific assets were concentrated in Antarctica. And we know that the Nazis had plenty of above-ground space as part of Base 211. You can be recalled in the first expedition to New Swabenland in 1938, they discovered huge ice-free areas. And it was very likely they constructed spaceship launch facilities in those areas, where they had easy access to many materials from underground. And most likely, these were camouflaged to prevent detection from above. Now, one person who was very instrumental in carrying this out was Hans Kammler. In 1944, Himmler convinced Hitler to put the V-2 rocket project directly under SS control, and on August 8, Kammler replaced Walter Dornberger as its director. Now, Kammler was a civil engineer who made his reputation by planning Auschwitz with its gas chambers and its human ovens, and he had a special talent for building huge underground facilities, employing slave labor, and getting projects done on time. But he also understood complicated engineering details, was uniquely capable of supervising advanced scientific programs. It's for this reason that Himmler put him in charge of the anti-gravity project at the Skoda Works, where the Hanabu craft was being built. So Kammler became the most knowledgeable person in Germany about anti-gravity spaceship design. From January 31, 1945, Kammler became head of all missile operations at Peenemünde in Germany. This meant that Wernher von Braun, a German pioneer in rocket technology, now answered to Kammler. And Kammler was partially responsible for the V-2 bombardments of London. Now, the Allied armies were now in France and advancing rapidly toward Berlin, but Hitler ordered the V-2 facility to remain in place until the moment the war front reached German borders. Kammler was promoted by Hitler to the top rank of the SS, and he was now the fourth most important person in the Third Reich. But he was now stretched very thin, since he also remained responsible for the entire secret anti-gravity weapons program at the Skoda Works. Hitler soon realized his only hope of winning the war was to defend against Allied bombing by getting the Hanabu military effective, which is why he depended on Kammler. But unfortunately, time had run out, and he was now planning his own survival. In March of 1945, partially under the advice of Goebbels, Hitler's gradually stripped gearing of several powers on aircraft support, as well as maintenance and supply, and transferred them to Kammler. The culmination in the beginning of April, with Kammler being raised to Führer's General Plenipotentiary for jet aircraft. Since the last V-2 on the Western Front had been launched in March of 1945, on April 1st, Kammler ordered the evacuation of 500 missile technicians to the Alps. On April 5th, Kammler was charged by the Oberkommando of the Army to command the defense of the area around the city of Nordhausen. However, rather than defend these missile construction works, immediately ordered the destruction of all the special V-1 equipment at the Sky Storage Site to keep this top-secret facility out of enemy hands. And that was his last known act. After that was completed, Kammler disappeared and was never seen again. Now, his disappearance was a great disappointment to U.S. General Dwight Eisenhower, the Supreme Commander of the Allied Expeditionary Forces in Europe. Four different versions of his so-called death were being circulated, all involving some form of suicide. But we know that Kammler remained very much alive, and he and his team had escaped the Base 211. When he got there, he was instrumental in the rapid development of the Hanabu craft in Antarctica. And this explains the flight of the Hanabu 3 to Mars in 1945 and the defeat of the American forces in Operation High Jump in 1947. As previously mentioned, thousands of slaves had already been sent to Antarctica by Himmler on large-capacity so-called milk cow submarines, as well as a contingent of 6,000 German scientists, so Kammler's workforce was already in place when he arrived. Base 211 was really part of a much larger colony in Antarctica that was not settled by Germans. It was connected to a city coincidentally called New Berlin, which apparently was much older than Base 211 and originally had no relationship to Berlin, Germany. There was a strange book that came out entitled Base, New Berlin, written in German, and it was sent to Kerry Cassidy at the Project Camelot website, written by somebody named Barabu Vedu. He claims he lived in that city for several years in a large building of glass and plastic, several square kilometers in area. He claimed the people on the base spoke English and an Indian language, though he himself spoke German. It's believed to have been an ancient extraterrestrial colony inhabited by diverse alien groups speaking languages the author believed to be Indian. Apparently, the Nazis used this colony as the foundation for Base 211. Vladimir Terzinski claims that New Berlin is now a modern city of over 2 million inhabitants. And apparently it now has tall office buildings and industrial areas able to accommodate contemporary corporate offices and manufacturing facilities. In all likelihood, the Nazis were given this facility by their invading friends, but they've now built it into an interplanetary base, although Jim Mars said the extraterrestrial quarter still exists and is inhabited by a diverse group of aliens living peacefully among their Nazi neighbors. As New Berlin expanded, advanced scientific research and industrial capacity grew quickly. This attracted the interest of existing German aerospace manufacturers who had started operations prior to or had survived the war and were now drawn to the Antarctic colony. According to Michael Sala in his book, Antarctica's Hidden History, in early 1939, the German secret societies had decided their space program would relocate to Antarctica, whose remoteness and deep cavern system under 2 miles of ice, which was accessible only by submarines, would provide all that was necessary to build such a program without possible disruption from the impending war. During World War II, extensive submarine activity in the region of Antarctica indicated the Nazis were building more bases in addition to the one Captain Reichsner's expedition had established in 1938. U.S. Navy spies reported once it became possible, major German companies involved in the Nazis' military-industrial complex began moving equipment, resources, and personnel down to Antarctica using Germany's vast fleet of submarines. And that's according to William Tompkins. Companies such as IG Farben, Krupp, Siemens, Messerschmitt, United Steelworks, or just some of the many involved in Antarctica's operations, which Tompkins specifically discussed from the Navy spy's intel. These advanced companies such as Luftwa Aeronautics, which was involved in advanced flight propulsion system and space station design, Astro und Feinwerk Technik, Autoschaff, the manufacturer of altitude control components and supplier of space systems, and DSI, Jena Optronic, and Daimler AG were just a few of the companies involved. Funds for the rapid expansion of Base 211 are readily available from Argentina, where Bormann was sitting on top of mountains of money from German banks, as well as precious metals, what was referred to as the loot of conquered Europe. When Hitler arrived in Argentina in late 1945, it's possible he directed Bormann to divert large investments to the development of Base 211. I've seen a good bit of material that purports to discuss the escape of Hitler and his wife, Eva Braun. It is known that an aircraft flown by Hitler's favorite pilot, a female, landed and took off with passengers. But it landed in Berlin, and it took off, and it was the last aircraft out. Meanwhile, things were changing quickly in post-war America. The Nazi takeover of the U.S. began with Operation Paperclip. At least 1,600 scientific and research specialists and thousands of their dependents were brought to the U.S. under the Operation Paperclip. Hundreds of others arrived under two other paperclip-related projects and went to work for universities, defense contractors, and CIA fronts. The paperclip operation eventually became such a juggernaut that in 1956, an American ambassador characterized it as a continuing U.S. recruitment program that has no parallel in any other allied country. The Nazis learned well the art and science of fifth column infiltration from their alien overlords, whose ancestors had destroyed and sunk beneath the waves the entire continent of Atlantis, according to legend. I'm one of the most advanced civilization ever to appear on this planet. Eventually, ex-Nazi scientists and technicians came to play a dominant role in the American aerospace industries and as contractors in the American military. This dominance reached a crescendo in 1960 with the appointment of Wernher von Braun as director of the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, the central facility of NASA. Now, an ex-Nazi SS officer had been instrumental in the V-2 rocket bombardment of London, killing thousands at the top position of America's burgeoning space program. The Nazi takeover of the American aerospace industry was now complete for all practical purposes. As the Nazi scientists became integrated into American aerospace corporations, these companies became Germanized and took on an international aspect rather than American, especially as the people running them became impressed with Nazi technology. Thus, as the 50s progressed and as executives of these companies sought to become aware that Nazi scientists were sending missions to the moon and Mars, they were anxious to open facilities at Base 211. Eventually, New Berlin became an international high-tech enclave of sophisticated space technology, much like Silicon Valley today. Most major American aerospace companies and scientific facilities became represented at Base 211. Now, Eisenhower, by this time the president of the United States, rather than a general, met with an alien contingent at Holloman Air Force Base near Alamogordo, New Mexico in February 1955 and made an agreement with him. Now, there's a lot of evidence regarding this meeting, and I've even seen movies that were taken. However, Eisenhower believed the aliens to be from elsewhere in the galaxy, where they were actually invaders from underground bases on Earth. The agreement permitted the aliens to abduct humans on a limited basis with full reporting back to our government in exchange for advanced technology. But as they always do, they broke the agreement almost immediately and began large-scale abductions without reporting. These abductees were used to create hybrids and forced labor at Base 211 and on the moon and on Mars. Many abductees were enslaved and traded to other extraterrestrial civilizations. Members of the U.S. military were abducted, exposed to advanced technology, and trained to be super soldiers. They became instrumental in the Alien My Lab program and were used to advance the alien agenda in the U.S. and on the moon and on Mars. While the Nazis infiltrated and began to dominate the aerospace industry in the 50s, at the same time they moved into our government and intelligence agencies and removed anybody who stood in their way, such as, according to many reports, President Kennedy. Clearly, it was no accident that both the Dulles brothers, John Foster and Allen, came into national public office in 1953, 1 year after Eisenhower began his presidency. Eisenhower moved into the presidency in 52, and that brought into power the ultra-conservative Republicans who before and after the war had business and banking connections with Nazi Germany and had been in sympathy with many aspects of the Nazi philosophy. John Foster Dulles became Secretary of State, and his younger brother, Allen, became the director of the CIA in 53. These two veterans of insider Washington skirmishes had now between them a lock on American foreign policy and a power influence on domestic policy. Easily able to manipulate the naive but well-intentioned president with absolutely no political experience. Now, the history of the Dulles brothers' affiliation with Hitler went back 20 years to his ascension to power in 1933. As lawyers with Sullivan and Cromwell in New York representing the Kuhn Loeb Company, they met with Hitler in Cologne, Germany on January 4, 1933 to negotiate short-term financing for Hitler to run for Chancellor of Germany. Later, both brothers were founding members of the Council on Foreign Relations, who avowed goal was one world government, the so-called New World Order. The ex-Nazis who infiltrated the U.S. government all sought to advance this globalist agenda. It was covertly understood by the deep insiders that the globalist agenda was actually a code phrase for what amounts to the Fourth Reich. At the CIA, Allen Dulles had developed a friendship with Reinhard Gehlen, the ex-Nazi spymaster who now directed the Gehlen Organization, a CIA asset in Germany that employed almost exclusively ex-Nazi spies. Now, given Dulles' history displaying sympathy for Nazi causes, it seems reasonable to conclude that Allen Dulles brought many of the Gehlen Organization agents into the CIA. In fact, in those early CIA days, the entire organization was dedicated to anti-Soviet activity and to fighting the Cold War. Virtually all the spies that Galen had employed in Europe were brought en masse to constitute the entire early CIA organization. Of course, in order to comply with demands by President Truman, their records were scrubbed to remove any mention of their Nazi histories. When Eisenhower came to the end of his presidency in 1960 and turned it over to Kennedy, he gave a farewell speech that clearly implied he understood what had happened during his 8 years in office. Having met with the aliens in 1955 and having a retrospective view of what the Dulles brothers had been up to, he felt it his patriotic duty to enunciate a dire warning to the American people. Eisenhower is obviously cognizant of the serious interference of the and the inference of the speech, since it went into through 21 drafts. It began by helping us to comprehend the huge implications of our new situation. When he said, "Now this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large armed industry is new to the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, but we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood all involved, so is the very structure of our society." Well, this remarkable statement is a recognition that the military has now assumed tremendous importance in American life, independent of any military challenges from other countries. Those with ears will understand that what he's saying is that there's dangers now from within. And from this, you should ask the logical question, how can our military be such a danger and threat to the American populace, whom those in its ranks are sworn to defend, and how can it threaten the very structure of our society? He was implying some dangerous foreign elements had crept into the U.S. military establishment, and frankly, there are many who feel he was referring to the Nazi influence. And if that's true, it fully explains the rest of the speech and why it took 21 drafts to get his point across diplomatically, choosing his words very carefully. He went on to say, "In the councils of government, we must guard against acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist." And a reason Eisenhower, an ex-general who knew well and trusted the military, would warn America about a possible military coup was the possibility it could occur because of that Nazi influence. In other words, he knew the Nazis had worked their way into the very fabric of our military-industrial complex, and as evidence of that, even as he gave that speech, Wernher von Braun was taken over the desk of the director of the Marshall Space Flight Center at NASA. Well, following the Eisenhower speech, active cooperation between the Nazis and the American military-industrial complex really got into high gear. According to the book Antarctica's Hidden History, the Dulles brothers, Prescott Bush, and U.S. bankers, industrialists, and public officials made it possible for a confluence of U.S. and German companies to reach agreements that would establish the Fourth Reich and the U.S. military-industrial complex as partners. Within a strictly compartmentalized security system, large U.S. companies worked with their smaller but more senior German partners in expanding out the industrial facilities in Antarctica. However, the U.S. companies were often left in the dark about the full details of how their products would be used. The final result of this system was that fleets of anti-gravity spacecraft were built in Antarctica under full German control, not only for interplanetary colonization but for interstellar conquest alongside their invading partners. Certainly, that meant that it was also the birth of the U.S. space program. Both Bill Tompkins and Corey Good have described the threat that this dark fleet posed for different human-looking extraterrestrial civilizations. So ironically, it seems that the birth of the dark fleet in Antarctica, which was ultimately to be headquartered on the moon, had its full assistance from U.S. corporations. And even more ominously, it was also the birth of the ICC, which eventually went on to settle on Mars, and ultimately, together with their Nazi Dark Fleet brothers, to rule the solar system with an iron hand. Now, after the first moon landing in 1942, the Nazi base expanded rapidly, according to the best information we can gather, first beneath the surface and above ground as they continued to send heavy construction equipment to the moon throughout the war and successive trips from Base 211 to Antarctica, New Swabenland, using the Hanabu 1 and 2 spacecraft. Initially, they were carefully to minimize and disguise the surface evidence of the base, which was inside a crater, even though it was on the dark side, since they knew that even though the dark side wasn't visible from Earth, eventually there'd be spacecraft from the U.S. and maybe other nations orbiting overhead. And as that first colony expanded, they abandoned their concerns about discovery and constructed a large surface building complex in the shape of a swastika. By 1960s, it became an 11-level, bell-shaped underground facility. There were already existing moon bases established by alien groups, some of which were extremely ancient. An article published on May 20, 2015, in the Exo News website, and on his own website, exopolitics.org, at a later date, Sala relates the testimony of Corey Good, who was taken to the moon by Mill Labs operatives. They were attached to that segment of the U.S. military that was working jointly with the invaders, the Greys, and the Illuminati. This was the so-called cabal. They had advanced propulsion technology and free access to the Nazi moon base, which ultimately became known as the Lunar Operations Command, or LOC. Even though it was under Nazi control, this base evolved into a sort of intergalactic United Nations type of facility. Representatives from throughout our galaxy could meet with entities in the solar system for commercial and political reasons. And the Nazis from Base 211 in Antarctica became known as the Dark Fleet. According to Sala, Corey describes the moon as a neutral space used by various secret space programs and extraterrestrial civilizations that have established embassy zones. He describes the moon as very similar to Antarctica, that is used by multiple nations that abide by international treaties for its peaceful use, even though some nations may be enemies. Significantly, his description of the moon as a diplomatic zone used by multiple space programs and extraterrestrial races matches another secret space program described by whistleblower Randy Kramer. And he refers to himself as Captain K because he does still have that rank in the Marines. Kramer revealed what was happening on the moon in an April 2014 interview. In that interview, he says, essentially, it's kind of like Antarctica. It has three different areas where different countries and people can say, we got this area and we got this, and everybody respects everybody's claim. Whether people are friendly or hostile, it's kind of a neutral territory, so there are places where those who can't get along with others are not too far from each other, but they don't attack because the contracts, diplomatic arrangements are for that. Kramer claims he's been part of a super soldier contingent on Mars for 17 years as an inductee in a 20-and-back program in which an inductee serves 20 years in a military unit or the duties on Mars and is mind wiped, de-aged, and turned back to his or her normal life at the exact time he or she was initially kidnapped. One of the questions posed to Good via email and reported in that same article was, what can you tell us about other shared human moon base used by the Dark Fleet? According to Good, it's a heavily guarded secret base. It's about the 10 o'clock position on the backside of the moon. The portion that is visible is a trapezoid shape. It's only accessible to the Dark Fleet and some ICC personnel, as well as the Draco Allied forces. Some amateur astronomers have caught videos of swarms of craft leaving from this base location on a couple of occasions. It's presumed to go far beneath the surface of the moon, just as the LOC does. Well, there's considerably more information available about this top-secret base from a mysterious source entitled Moon and Mars Bases that was posted on the Internet. It's uncertain how reliable this information may be, but the huge amount of details does testify to its authenticity. In this article, we learn that there are five linked bases, mainly on the dark side of the moon, but protruding into the left fringe is viewed from Earth, where there is still some available light, and therefore these bases are somewhat visible. Apparently, the aliens and the Nazis don't feel it necessary to construct these bases underground. Actually, in view of the base's purpose, that would have been difficult, if not impossible anyway. Because of the linkages, these bases actually compose a large single compound, which is the home base and headquarters of the Dark Fleet in this solar system. Base 1 is an interstellar spaceport that accommodates large spaceships of different types from all over the solar system and beyond. Apparently, they have the ability to house and perform maintenance on a variety of craft. According to the article, the purpose is to receive spaceships of different kinds. That means that from there they also take off. Here they get prepared for longer trips, same as in our international airport. They can land. So big ships prefer to come here to load or unload, and then from this place they go down to Earth. One of the big areas in use was storage space included. Some very advanced technologies available on this base for installation and implementation of equipment on the spaceships they service. They apparently have the capability of tailoring the technology to many different types of spacecraft. Space also includes a training facility to prepare the spaceship crews for various missions on different planets, including specifically Mars and Andromeda. This preparation includes the use of a cryogenic facility to fast freeze bodies for long journeys. There's surface-level living quarters on the base for crews that have to spend time waiting for technology implementations or repairs or training. Personnel on this base are not afraid of being observed from Earth, since superficially at least, all seems peaceful from afar. The staff on the base consists of 199 ETs of various types and 500 hybrids. They have the use of 17 spaceships for administrative purposes. The base is surrounded by half vegetation supplied with water from 1,500 feet under the surface. And base 2 might be called the abductee briefing station. This base is for higher level abductees who have considerable influence over others back on Earth and who therefore require more targeted and carefully designed debriefings. How they train spies, attend debriefings, and float around trying to elicit information that's not otherwise revealed. If traitors are discovered at this point, they're shot. Abductees then go through a memory erasure program. These missions are so secure that even the gray workers going back to Andromeda go through this memory wipe. New arrivals are given data implants accompanied by special drugs, and these implants remain in place under the level of the subconscious, which causes the abductee to act robotically. Base 3 is reminiscent of the holodeck on the Star Trek. It's dedicated to recreation. According to the author, spaces have been created for different activities, such as sports and movies and paths for walking, which at the same time link to the different bases. There are machines for entertainment, comfortable sitting spaces, areas for sleeping, swimming pools, small stadium for contest. Base 4 is the Special Coordination Center. It's the smallest of the five bases in the area and is the most important. It's the main dark fleet base on the moon. It's got the highest security and is considered a restricted area. Only work done here relates to very special missions and important people, especially the handling of delicate situations. From this base, communication lines radiate out to Earth, Mars, spaceships throughout the solar system and beyond. Various other locations and bases on other planets, especially those in Andromeda, which is their home base. Now, the working staff consists of 100 ETs and 130 hybrids, are very bright and specialized. Homo sapiens, or humans, are especially forbidden on this base, and if any are discovered, they are immediately terminated. Any human who mistakenly finds him or herself there will not leave alive. The entire base is protected by a special metal shield that's impervious to cosmic rays, and the base houses miniaturized computers with a luminous capacity from which data of interest can be extracted and displayed. It's a busy place, and the work done there is continuous without a break. And Base 5, of course, is part of the same area as Base 4. All the energy for the entire compound is produced there. Houses the main workshops where electromagnetic tools and lasers are used to repair mechanical equipment. Staff consists of 70 extraterrestrial engineers and 110 skilled hybrids. Homo sapiens are not permitted to learn these skills. They can watch the procedures, but they're not taught how to perform them. It's not a restricted area. The path made to come there is used for walking. No danger of radiation. According to British author Timothy Good in his book Above Top Secret regarding the Apollo 11 mission, according to former NASA employee Otto Binder, unnamed radio hams at their own VHF receiving facilities that bypassed NASA's broadcasting outlets picked up the following exchange. NASA, what's there? Mission Control calling Apollo 11. Apollo, these babies are huge, sir, enormous. Oh, my God, you wouldn't believe it. I'm telling you, there are other spacecraft out there lined up on the far side of the crater edge. They're on the moon watching us. In 1979, Maurice Chatelain, former chief of NASA communication system, confirmed Armstrong did indeed report seeing two UFOs on the rim of a crater. He said the encounter was common knowledge in NASA, but nobody's talked about it until now. Soviet scientists were allegedly the first to confirm the incident. According to our information, the encounter was reported immediately after the landing of the module. According to Vladimir Azhaza, a physicist and professor of mathematics at Moscow State University, Neil Armstrong relayed the message to Mission Control that two large mysterious objects were watching him after having landed near the moon module. But this message was never heard by the public because NASA censored it. According to another Soviet scientist, Alexander Kazantsev, Buzz Aldrin took color movie film of the UFOs from inside the module and continued filming them after he and Armstrong went outside. Azhaza claims that the UFOs departed minutes after the astronauts came out onto the lunar surface. And Marie Chatelain also confirmed that Apollo 11's radio transmissions were interrupted on several occasions in order to hide the news from the public. Italian journalist and UFO researcher Luca Scantamberlo traveled to Rwanda, Africa, May 25, 2007, to get an interview with the next U.S. astronaut named William Rutledge, commander of the alleged Apollo 20 moon mission in August of 1976, who was living there at the time. Now, this mission, which was a top-secret joint American-Russian operation, originated at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California and received absolutely no publicity. At the time of the interview, Rutledge was 76 years old and recalled events that had taken place 41 years earlier, so some slips or gaps in memory certainly took place. Nevertheless, his recall of dates, technical details, and events from so long ago was actually exceptional. Rutledge wrote the following in the foreword of the published interview. I don't use English since 1990, but can Rwanda in French, and I write quickly. Sometimes letters are missing because I'm busy writing the next one, or it's another on the keyboard, which is used, but that's a detail. Sensational aspect of that mission was its investigation of a massive, extremely ancient alien spaceship that had been found completely intact and nestled in between two huge outcroppings on the dark side of the moon, which was first photographed by the crew of Apollo 15 from overhead. It was measured by the astronauts and found to be 11,056 feet long. Well, the craft, I guess, could be compared to a New York City multi-block area. Inside it was a small triangular craft. Nearby were the ruins of an ancient alien city with lofty spires. Two bodies were found inside the smaller craft, including, lying on her back in one of the pilot chairs, a perfectly preserved female. She closely resembled an ethnic Mongolian woman from Earth in terms of both facial features and complexion. Rutledge reported the discovery back to Mission Control at Vandenberg, at which time she was christened by one of the astronauts as Mona Lisa, maybe because of the perfection of her preservation, comparing that perfection to the painting by Da Vinci. Rutledge reported to Mission Control that Mona Lisa seemed not dead, but she certainly wasn't alive. The other body, a male, presumably the co-pilot of the small craft, was in a state of serious deterioration except for the head. The astronauts severed the head and took it back to the lunar module along with the intact Mona Lisa. Rutledge estimated the age of that spaceship to be about 1.5 million years old. And I've got an excerpt from the interview of Rutledge by Scantamberlo. Rutledge was asked, what about the Mona Lisa EBE? How does she look? Where was she at the time when you found her on the moon? Where do you think she is now? Rutledge responded, Mona Lisa, I don't remember who named the girl. Leonov or me, it was the intact EBE, humanoid, female, 1.65 meters, genitalized, haired, six fingers. We guess that mathematics are based on a dozen. Seemed to be the pilot. The piloting device was fixed to fingers and eyes, no clothes. We had to cut two cables connected to the nose, though. There were no nostrils. Then they have unfixed the eye device. Concretions of blood or bile liquid erupted and froze over the mouth and eyes and nose and some parts of the body. Some parts of the body were in unusually good condition. Hair and skin was protected by a thin, transparent protection layer. As we said, the Mission Control, the condition seemed not dead, but not alive. We didn't have a medical background or experience, but Leonov and I used a test. We fixed our bioequipment on the EBE, and telemeter received by surgeon was positive. That was the Mission Control med folks. But that's another story. Some parts would be unbelievable now. I prefer to tell the whole story when other videos will be online. This experience had been filmed in the lunar module. We found a second body, destroyed. We brought the head on board. The color of the skin was blue-gray, a pastel blue. Skin had some strange details above the eyes and the front, a strap around the head, wearing no inscription. The cockpit was full of calligraphy and formed of long semi-hexagonal tubes. She's on Earth, and she's not dead, but I prefer to post other videos before telling what happened there. Now, this remarkable discovery is clear evidence of ancient settlements on our moon. We know now from the recent testimonies of Corey Good and Randy Kramer that there are still many alien colonies on the moon, at least one of which possesses the huge craft that appeared on the rim of the crater during the Apollo 11 exploration. The claim she's not dead is frankly astounding. That's an ancient civilization that had the technology to preserve human bodies for over a million years stretches credibility to the breaking point. The returning memories of mill labs that were taken to the moon for short periods corroborate some of the information we've learned from other sources. In an article published on exopolitics.org website entitled Secret Moon Base Uses Abducted Humans as Slave Labor, Sala writes, a member of the public forum, The One Truth, alerted Corey Good to the claims of Carolyn Hamlet, who says she witnessed a moon base that she was taken to. She recalled the shape of the base as being trapezoid and recreated it. And in her recreation, she said, the picture is my recreation from my memory. Put the picture together to illustrate what I'd seen with physical eyes while aboard a lunar-bound craft with other humans. The trapezoid-shaped building was our destination. My first thought when I saw this structure was it was unique and significant shape, that of a decapped pyramid, and how much in architecture reminded me of the Pentagon as seen in aerial views. So I chose a portion of an aerial photograph of the Pentagon to best illustrate the architecture of the actual building I saw on the moon. The rendition I've created is very much like the view I had as the craft I was in was making its approach. But the actual building on the lunar surface does not have an inner courtyard. You know, in 1958, the U.S. Army came up with Operation Horizon, which was plans to build a permanent moon base to be staffed, I think, by 16 soldiers on a permanent basis. And since money was allocated, nothing the government's ever allocated money for has ever not been done. So I would tend to bet that there is a moon base of some type. In an interview, Hamlet recalls being inside the spacecraft approaching the moon base. She says that her memory then cut out in the craft, and she next recalled being inside the moon base and witnessed a council-type meeting with up to 30 global leaders from around the world, led by a prominent female. She says the base had been built in collaboration with gray ETs who couldn't be trusted when manipulating the humans at the base by misleading them into believing they were in control. Now, Hamlet doesn't fully recall what happened during the rest of her time inside the moon base. According to Good, there's very little intelligence on what is happening inside the moon base used by the Dark Fleet. In addition to Carolyn Hamlet's testimony, there's a MyLab who claims to have been taken to a secret remote base while gray ETs play a role and recalls traumatic experiences happening to her. Nara Terra Isley is a former U.S. Air Force radar tracking operator who was forcibly recruited into a covert program when she witnessed a UFO while performing her official Air Force duties when she traveled with other U.S. Air Force personnel on an assignment to the Tonopah Test Range in 1980. She and her colleagues were instructed to attempt to get a radar lock on a glowing UFO and were then taken into custody by a covert faction of the Air Force. Then exposed to a number of traumatic experiences in these My Labs, which she described at length in her book, Facing the Shadow, Embracing the Light, which she published in 2013. She revealed she was taken between 8 and 10 times to a secret moon base that was guarded by reptilians and it used human workers. Now, her description is testimonial evidence that slave labor is both used on the moon and that My Labs were taken there for that purpose, either for short periods or for indefinite periods, as occurs on Mars. While she didn't describe the shape of the moon base she was taken to, her experiences with reptilian guards and physical abuse along with other human workers suggest it's the Dark Fleet base that Good has described. Further, she described the gray ETs piloting the shuttlecraft taking her to the moon, which is consistent with what Carolyn Hamlet said about grays being involved in that base's operation. Good's revelation of an exploited Dark Fleet base on the far side of the moon is now supported to varying degrees by two independent witnesses and tallies perfectly with what we already know about that base. Hamlet's recollection of the base is that global leaders were taken there and manipulated by gray ETs. Isley's recollection is that grays and reptilians are involved in at least one moon base and allow human workers to be mistreated. And there's at least one secret base on the far side of the moon that manipulates human leaders taken there and uses abducted man labs as slave labor. Now, John Lear has had a long and distinguished career as a commercial pilot and aviation authority. With that very pragmatic and scientific background in which he was responsible for the lives of thousands of passengers on his planes, he wouldn't be somebody you would expect to entertain fantastic theories. But he believes the moon currently has a population of about 250 million human beings. And yet, when you see him defend that theory in his YouTube videos, you very quickly become a believer also. Currently, after reading the material that he has published, you'd have good reason to believe him because all points to agreement with the veracity of that belief, if not with the actual number of humans on the moon. That possibility becomes even more believable when Lear informs us that the gravity on the moon is about 69% of the gravity exerted on Earth and that the atmosphere is roughly equivalent to ours at an altitude of 18,000 feet. It's about the same as the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro. Lear says it takes about 1 week of decompression to become accustomed to the thinner lunar atmosphere. And Vladimir Terzinski, the dissident scientist, agrees entirely. He says, in my extensive research of dissident American theories about physical conditions on the moon, I've proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that there is atmosphere, water, and vegetation on the moon, and that man does not need a spacesuit to walk on the moon. A pair of jeans, a pullover, and sneakers are just about enough. And that explains how a large human population can exist on the moon. So the big question is, where did all these people come from? Lear says they're not from Earth, by which I take it he means they're not from the Adamic race that originated on Earth about 50,000 years ago. But they could have been descended from the Atlanteans who were pre-Adamic. That'll explain why they're far more spiritually advanced than we are. Well, when you go into detail, you come up with a lot of material that can actually be confirmed. And since it all ties into the mysterious base 211 and all the research that's been done by so many people on some of the advances the Nazis did, the whole theory hangs together very tightly. I might point out that I read in one of the German magazines, the English version, about the test pilot and that went into orbit in either 43 or 44. And they're talking about already having bases on the moon in 42. I think that may be a little bit precipitous, but at the same time, there was work being done on base 211 as early as 1938. So certainly, it is as advanced as they were. German technology may well have gotten to the point where they could actually put people on the moon in 1942. We've come to the end of another show. We'll be back Monday. Once again, this will be Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great weekend.